1, 2, 3, 4.
When I write my stories, I don't want to solve things in life. I just want to persuade myself that there is a way out. You know, maybe I'm in a cell, maybe I'm trapped, maybe I won't make it. But if I can imagine of a plan to escape, then I'll be less trapped. Because at least in my mind, there is a way. And my parents as survivors, they always talked about this idea of humanity. My parents always said to me, when you look at people, don't look at their political views. They're not that important. Look at the way that they look at you. If they see you, if they listen to you, if they can understand your intention, even if it's a failing one, then they're your people. And if they can't, it doesn't matter. You can vote to the same party. You can hold the same ideas. They're not your people. And I think that, you know, in the Second World War, a lot of people had experienced betrayal, experienced the world shaking. And I think that when I came with my mother and father's thing, that there are people, there are human beings, and there are people who want to be human beings but are still struggling, and you go with humanity. You go with the person that can go against his ideology if his heart tells him something. You know, and I think that right now, where I'm really in a double whammy kind of situation, where I'm blacklisted in my own country. Like in the Israeli Fox News, they call to boycott Grossman's book and mine. The city in which I've been teaching for more than 20 years, I can't afford a public event there because I'm a traitor to my people or whatever. And at the same time, I was supposed to have a big tour in Australia. It got canceled because I'm Israeli. I was supposed to come to Edinburgh, cause a problem because I'm Israeli. So the idea is that I feel there is some kind of feeling of intolerance that I don't have any problem with the fact that the people in my country think that killing a Palestinian civilian is legitimate. I can argue with them, but I have a problem with the fact that there are people that don't want to allow me any kind of opinion. And I'm saying I grew up in an occupying country with many strong liberal forces, but all the time I knew that the fascists will shut you up. And today, everybody wants to shut you up. And today we live in this kind of a world of one strike, you're out. We're living in this twisted world where everybody is oppressing everybody.
Edgar Keret is one of the most inventive and celebrated short story writers of his generation, a voice that captures the absurdities and profound loneliness of modern life. With a deceptive, almost casual wit, his work, translated into dozens of languages, uses fantastical premises from alien visitations to parallel universes to illuminate the most human of truths. His new collection, Autocorrect, explores a world grappling with technology, loss, and the aftershocks of a global pandemic, and more recently, war. His awards include the Cannes Film Festival's Camera d'Or, the Charles Bronfman Prize, and the prestigious Sapir Prize. He's also the new MFA director of the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, where he's pioneering a new approach to storytelling. Joining me from Tel Aviv is the great Israeli writer and filmmaker Edgar Keret. Welcome back to the creative process, Edgar.
Hi. Time of my life would be an understatement, but I think that generally I lived with some kind of an illusion that I'm kind of in a dialogue with the word, you know, that the word listens to me and I listen to the word, and that I can change it a bit and it can change me a bit. And I'm saying right now, with all the horror happening in my region, with a needless war that kills thousands and thousands of civilians and keep kidnapped, tortured, internally, then this idea that there is something that you're fundamentally against, you know, it's as if like you see, I don't know, somebody torturing a child or something like that, that you really understand in your core that if you could do one thing, you would change that. And understanding that what you're doing doesn't work day in, day out for 2 years. So I'm saying it's really kind of this feeling of futility is something I have to fight. You know, I'm saying in every sentence, when you ask me a question, I have to kind of master some kind of energy, even just to look at you and say something. And I'm saying, like, I'm not, I hope I'm not victimizing myself, because I'm not saying, you know, please, I'm going to pass my hat in the end and everybody throw me back. But I'm just want to say that my feeling maybe intense, but I think that it's the universal human feeling right now. It's this feeling of a powerless God, of an entity that knows of all the atrocities around it, but has no power whatsoever to change them. You know, I can blabber as much as I want on my Facebook page, but in the bottom line, people are dying. I can't do anything about it. All the people I talk about, they're not stopping it. They can boycott me for not saying what they want me to, or can share my posts because they think that I'm saying wonderful things. But all of us, it feels as if all of us are spectators in some kind of a show that we have no effect on. It's like there is a football game and the fans are from the different team are punching each other at their seats. You know, it doesn't affect the game. The idea that I want my team to win, the idea that I want them to lift the cup, it's like I would give my heart and kidney and brain for that. But I just can't. And it's heartbreaking, you know, day in, day out, just to be reminded how powerless you are against the world.
Yeah, it's, you know, you talk about, I know that you're not religious, but a lot of your stories have throughout your career talked about, I guess, the bus driver who wanted to be God or the afterlife. I mean, and in this new collection as well, there's this speculation of like what lies beyond, whether it's parallel universes or whatever. I guess that's part of the wish to be able to change things. Okay, I don't like it the way this is, but maybe if I go down these pipes, an early story of yours, or if I go down, I can find another way through. And it might sound absurd, but it's no more absurd than this world that we're experiencing now.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think that when I write my stories, I don't want to solve things in life. I just want to persuade myself that there is a way out. You know, maybe I'm in a cell, maybe I'm trapped, maybe I won't make it. But if I can imagine a plan to escape, then I'll be less trapped. Because at least in my mind, there is a way. And I think that my parents as survivors, they always talked about this idea of humanity. You know, my parents always said to me, when you look at people, don't look at their political views. They're not that important. Look at the way that they look at you. If they see you, if they listen to you, if they can understand your intention, even if it's a failing one, then they're your people. And if they can't, it doesn't matter. You can vote to the same party. You can hold the same ideas. They're not your people. And I think that, you know, in the Second World War, a lot of people had experienced betrayal, had experienced the world shaking. And I think that when I came with my mother and father's thing, that there are people, there are human beings, and there are people who want to be human beings but are still struggling, and you go with humanity. You go with the person that can go against his ideology if his heart tells him something, you know? And I think that right now, where I'm really in a double whammy kind of situation, where I'm blacklisted in my own country. There are, like in the Israeli Fox News, they call to boycott Grossman's book and mine. The city in which I've been teaching for more than 20 years, I can't hold a public event there because I'm a traitor to my people or whatever. And at the same time, you know, I was supposed to have a big tour in Australia. It got canceled because I'm Israeli. I was supposed to come to Edinburgh. It caused a problem because I'm Israeli. So the idea is that I feel there is some kind of feeling of intolerance, that I don't have any problem with the fact that the people in my country think that the killing a Palestinian civilian is legitimate. You know, I can argue with them, but I have a problem with the fact that there are people that don't want to allow me any kind of opinion. And I'm saying I grew up in an occupying country with many strong liberal forces. But all the time I knew that the fascist will shut you up. And today, everybody wants to shut you up. The liberals want to shut you up. The anti-vaccinator want to shut you out. The pro-vaccinator want to shut you up. Everybody's fighting what movies to take off YouTube, you know? And the idea is that, you know, that the way that I was raised is that you grow up and you learn who you are by making countless mistakes and paying for them. Well, it's really like you do something stupid, you're not considerate, then you get punished, you go on, you know. And today we live in this kind of a world of one strike, you're out. I see young people, you know, as a student, they're shivering. They know that if in one wrong context, they say one wrong sentence, they'll be sleeping on the sidewalk. And I find that this kind of oppression, when people talk about a maid's tale and stuff like that, then for me, it's already here. And it's much worse because it always in our fears, there is one group oppressing another. But we're living in this twisted world where everybody is oppressing everybody. I know that I talk it up, but can I tell an anecdote? A few years ago, I was in Boston and I spoke in one of the biggest universities there. I won't maybe mention the name. I don't know, because maybe the story will get me into trouble, so it's good to be vague. But I spoke to a group of students and there was a super intelligent young student there. And at some stage, this student said to me, "Listen, I'm a lesbian and I won't stop fighting until the place that I live will become a safe space where I can go hand in hand in the shopping mall to buy myself an ice cream and kiss my partner on the lips without anyone looking at me. And I won't fight until this happens." And I told her, there is no such thing as a safe space. We are living in a jungle. There are safer spaces. If the words that you wish for would be realized, it would mean that your Catholic, homophobic, elderly neighbor, when he'll go to shopping mall, he won't live in a safe space because it's totally unsafe to him to see two girls kissing. So this idea that there is the right way to live, that we should push it down the throat of everyone, is wrong. And it's totally indoctrinated by social media because, you know, Mia, when you and me, we used to live in a village and I was your neighbor, then you say, people ask you, "What do you think about Edgar?" And they say, you said, "He talks too much. I go, I want to buy something in the grocery store. He catches me, start talking to me about AI and what would happen if he would be born an alien. But whenever I go overseas, he waters my plants and he takes care of everything." So in the end, you have some kind of a complex view of myself. And in this view, if I'll say a sentence that is wrong, you say, "Edgar told me this dumb sentence, but he's very good with dogs," you know, and it will be this complexity. But in this kind of world where we're living, where we just meet people on a sentence, on an incident, it's very similar to some kind of a global road rage scenario where, you know, in the US, people can get out of the car and shoot somebody because he cuts them. Now, if these guys that cuts them went to high school with them, they would never shoot him because they know he's funny and that he's generous and that even in high school, he didn't know how to drive. And there is this kind of package that is human. But the moment that you just meet people on one thing, it becomes monstrous. It becomes an inquisition, a McCarthy, a kind of witch hunt kind of feeling.
Yeah, and it's so, this that judgment, there's no room for due process. And it's bad for democracy, of course, but it's bad for society. And it's, of course, bad for art. So you mentioned there finding escape in your stories too. We see that a lot. I was sort of surprised that in your latest collection, Autocorrect, that although I know most of the stories were written before October 7th, that there was little mention of war. But it's a lot of stories about people's personal lives. But what there is a lot of is this kind of sense of escape. There is like the parallel worlds or... So it seems like if there's a metaphor of conflict or the war zone, it's like the personal lives could be a kind of war zone and could be treacherous. The danger and the darkness is inside, kind of like what you're saying. You know, we're full of all this kind of road rage waiting to come out. And then there is that disconnection and loss. Like, so again, this, I don't know, it's because we're reading it now in the aftermath of October 7th, but you have this disconnection or loss, but things aren't mentioned, say, explicitly, because that's still kind of, was still looming, you know, ready to happen.
Yeah, I think, you know, that there is this tale that is probably an urban legend, this guy that he suffered from a very heavy depression and wasn't really functioning. And one day he got up and he said, "You know what? I'm going to take a shower and I'm going to go and I'm going to pay all my debts and I'm going to be okay. And he took a shower and he went to his cafe and he said, I owe you $20. I want to pay you the $20. They say, it's okay. You know, no, come another day, you know. And he went to another place and he says, I owe you for the laundry. And he said, look, everything fine, just go. And then he went to Main Avenue and he saw the Twin Towers on fire. And then he went home and he brought a blanket and he put it on the pavement and he lay down and he felt a relief. And he said, finally, everyone is feeling the way I feel. Now, I can say that when I lived in Israel before the 7th of October, the sensations of a doomsday fear, the xenophobia, the fear from the other, the enmity, they were always there. When you see this war, it's an eruption of something. And as a writer, you sense it not as an action, but as some sort of an energy. It's as if, you know, you and me will sit in the room and I'll say to you, Mia, can you smell this? Can you smell this? And you will say no. And as a writer, I have maybe a better sense of smell, but what I'm smelling is that there is a body in a closet in the room that we're sitting on. So maybe the body will be found later, but the stench was there long before it.
Yeah, exactly. There's this sense of menace. And I think that's the thing that you do brilliantly, because you undercut it with humor. So at the same time, and also because of the brevity of your story. So we know that jokes are short. Like if it's a novel, it's going to be depressing because we're going to see every detail. But because of that, the thing that you do, it's kind of sped up. So it's like in a different motion, different sense of movement. So it undercuts it. So we don't have to live long time in the grief, although we just know it's there. There's that stench of the body in the corner that none of us wants to look at. But then you wrap it in this other sense that lets us go through the hard stuff, but also, you know, get to the light on the other side.
It's really like I'm saying, sometimes when you go to a hotel, there is this kind of pianist that plays in the bar. So I would say that as a writer, I was playing in the bar of humanity life. I was playing and I was looking and I saw two people kissing and I wrote about how it's beautiful. And I saw a man cheating on his wife and I wrote about how it's, you know, so there was this thing. Now, currently life for all the trajectory of humanity feels as if we're constantly falling down the stairs. So I'm playing a music for people who are falling down the stairs. It's a little bit kind of like a Charlie Chaplin kind of music. The idea is that I'm doing whatever I can to empathize with you, to hope with you, to see the good in life in you while we're both falling down the stairs. I wish that one day I won't feel that we're falling down the stairs. You know, maybe when it happens, I'll stop writing or maybe I'll start playing a different tune. But for now, it's really, really this kind of, it's like I feel that I'm the band on the Titanic. You know, I'm playing a good music for getting your trousers wet in cold water. I'm playing the music that together with that will make it most bearable. I really feel the story of humanity is a very simple one. You have some kind of a culture, or a set of ethics. It doesn't matter. It's a kind of being able to transcend things that were done before. And then it all crashes. And then we are running in the forest with spears. And then we do it again. And then it all crashes. In a sense, this is how science advances. This is the way that culture advances. It's not continuous. You do something, it destroys, on its ruins, you build something. And that's all okay. The thing that is super scary about the situation now is not that we are reliving this story, is that we are losing the story. I have no problem with tragic tales. I have problem with no stories. You know, so I'm saying, for example, if you look at the story of the Second World War compared to World War today. So let's say when they ask Trump, are you going to bomb Iran? He says, you don't know. I don't know, come tomorrow, okay? If you'd ask Winston Churchill, are you going to keep fighting Hitler? He wouldn't say, come on Thursday, I'll give you an answer. He would say, of course. Now, the fact that I could predict his answer means that there is a story, because a story is consisted by the sum of the decision the protagonist takes. So I always say, if Raskolnikov, instead of killing the old woman, would buy ice cream, we will call it ice cream and punishment and not crime and punishment. This is what creates the tale. So what my fear is that we are living in a world that nobody controls, and that basically the fact that we are passive, we're not making any decisions, means that we don't have a story. And this is like, it's easy to show it. That, for example, you know, Mia, in another world, I ask you to go with me on a date, and on this date, we fight which movie we'll go to. And you says, I want to see comedy, yeah, I love comedy. And they say, no, I want to see something very artistic and boring. And then we go to the comedy, and then it sucks. And then I say, oh, Mia, you're such a great person, but how can you go to a Meg Ryan movie? Shame on you. So what happens is that the choice of the movie becomes a part of your character. But when you see a movie, a clip on Instagram, it could be the cutest cat in the world. You didn't choose it. So the story doesn't advance. I don't know any more of the Mia character when if you watch a clip of a cat or a clip of a rapper saying kill the police or a clip of somebody teaching how to make meringue while you're in a swimming trunks. You know, all those things can be fun or not fun, but you as a character do not develop. The story does not develop. So I'm saying that if we lived in a world where two ideologies clashed, there were two narratives fighting, now we live in a world of no narrative in which we identify stuff as some kind of an opposing story. But you know what? People are fighting us. They're as miserable as we are. You understand? I'm saying the simple math of a clash is that if one loses, the other wins. But look at Israel right now. Who's winning? The liberals will not. The Palestinians, of course not. You know, Netanyahu, everybody wants, he's going to be in Hague. Everybody, he says, why those people are crazy? You know, Trump, he's totally frustrated. You know, nobody's happy. Nobody's winning. And the idea is that if you play a game in which you don't have a chance to win, because then the game should be changed. The energies that we put so much into pushing inside a system that already showed us that it doesn't give, you know, really kind of creates a world in which all our life is filled with vile energies of hatred and anger and aggression. And I'm saying, you know where I meet these energies? When I see a kid in a tantrum. If you take a kid and you say, I buy you ice cream and the store is closed, you'll see the American conservative, the American woke, the Israeli liberal. It's this kind of crazy tantrum. You know, it's this kind of joy that when people don't think like you, that they're suffering. It's this idea, we've blocked them. Nobody's planting a tree. We're just chopping our neighbor's tree. And I'm saying that this is what hits me. If you would say in 20 years there will be no books, then I would say fuck books, you know. We will dance naked in the forest and eat sweet things. But if you say to me that the place that we're heading to is a place in which we stopped being a fish swimming and we became a leaf in a stream with no control and no knowledge of our future. You know, it's really like, look at Trump, it's easy. So what's going to happen? Is he going to buy Greenland? Will he invade Canada? Will he send all the immigrants there? Will he stop healthcare and everybody would die? We don't know.
The reality, I actually just recently interviewed a soap, she's an actress, she's done serious films, but she's also was on soap operas. And I said, well, it's a soap opera presidency. It's like they say, it's a reality presidency. You don't know, but you have to kill off somebody in the next episode. You know, it's constant. So I feel
true. But again, I don't think it's a soap opera in this idea that, you know, a soap opera, if you watch it for 10 years, then when you see an episode, you have an edge on somebody who never saw an episode. You say, oh, I know this guy, he's bad. Now, what's happening right now, it's not a soap opera. It's watching a bunch of Instagram clips. So the idea is that you can see something that is funny and then something that is depressing and then something that is sexy and then something that is capitalistic and then something that is socialistic. And there is no connection between one clip to another. It's not the same character. It's really like, I'm saying, you know, I saw the prior episode. There was no Greenland in it, ever. It came from nowhere. You know, it's as if like you watch soap and every episode, the characters are played by different actors and they change their name and they change their attitude, that's the idea of losing the story. A telenovela is a bad story, but it's a story. And I wish, I yearn for a bad story for us to share.
Yeah, it's true. It stopped making sense. And I think it was always sort of the case under capitalism that we were sort of like a hamster on a wheel. But now, as you're talking about it, you know, it's like we're a hamster on a wheel that's owned by the technology companies. And now the technology companies have come up with an AI hamster. Almost, you don't even have to do anything.
Yeah.
I have a question. But first, I have like a secret. You know me as a painter, as a podcaster, but another part of me, as much as I love reading, is I love writing from the time I was a child. Because for me, stories are the best place to share how the mind works, to make sense of this crazy world. And paintings aren't so good at that. If you ask me, what is the meaning of life? I'm not going to say, wait a second, let me paint you the Sistine Chapel. And this, for me, it's never Marcel Proust or anything, but his stories come out very quickly because I remember my dreams and I like to write them down as soon as I remember it, or I write quickly between paintings. And I was always kind of proud of that. It's my own voice. It's quick. That was the one good thing. But then when AI was launched, I got very sad because AI is so quick. I mean, some of it is really lousy writing, but some of it's inventive. And it's in a blink, it has a whole story. So I think that they were all kind of experiencing this now. The stuff that we thought we controlled, that was us, that was creativity, was our individual stamp. It's almost like, what's the point? I still always believe we need storytellers. Like you said, we need to have a world that makes sense. And I wonder what you thought about AI. You know, it made me think about, where do our ideas come from? What is imagination? Is it just processing speed? What is the human essential part to this? Because it's like we're going down, as you say, a leaf in the stream. What is the future of humanity if it's all going to be done for us?
Yeah, so I took a taxi ride and the driver said to me, you know, in San Francisco, they have autonomous cars and they're going to replace me. And AI is going to write story and it's going to replace us. What are we going to do? And I said to him, you know, that when there will be autonomous car, you could still have a car and drive in your backyard, and I could still write my stories. And the question is, are we doing what we're doing because the fact that we feel that we are unique and can do something that no one else can gives us some a kind of a sense of purpose? Or are we doing things just because we're exploring this world and we want to know ourselves and our dialogue with it better? So I'm saying, if you were somebody that I would ask you, what are you? And you would say, a lawyer. And I would say, what is your contribution to life? And you say, I sue people. And I would say, what would you want to be? And you say, more successful lawyer. Then you're totally screwed. Because in the end, but if you're saying, I'm Mia and I'm doing this, and some of the stuff that I used to do, I did it to survive, to have an identity in a world that demanded a professional identity. But now life is different. So what I do, I kind of do it more for myself. If you imagine, let's say that we're a tree that has deep roots and tries to touch the sky. We live in a world where our effort is only to touch the sky. But I'm saying we should inverse it, and we should be in a world that will begin and be centered on our roots.
Well, that's a beautiful metaphor. But we do get something when we do it professionally and we do it for an audience. There's something that's missing when we're just doing it on our own.
And I know that AI can't replace the best storytellers. And I know that stories are one of the reasons why we matter, and creativity isn't just speed or output. What we add is the context, the feeling, the messy, beautiful humanness, and that experience behind the work. I'm not sure if the future is about competition, and maybe it's about collaboration, and we won't be replaced. If we're smart about this, we can be amplified, and it can open up other possibilities. But I do wonder about AI and the future of storytelling.
And I do think the stories that matter most are the ones only humans can tell.
So my mother told me something when she would tell me a lot of stuff when I was young. And some of it I didn't completely understand, but I kind of just knew that my mother was always right. So I said, maybe one day I understand because she'd be right. And one of the things that she said, in good times, if you go on the street and you hear somebody shouting over here, don't walk there, run. because there will be music and booze and girls and good food, and you don't want to miss it. She said, in bad times, if somebody shouts over here, don't go, because this is where they murder people. And what I'm telling you is not an hypothesis. I've been there. I was with people. They went, I didn't, they're dead, I'm alive. So I think when she said it to me, when you're an 8-year-old child, you don't really understand that. But today, when I look at what she was saying, it was really, really obvious. The cultural greed, the frame in which we live, it's like a railing. When we walk, we can lean on it, but we can lean on it only if it can hold our weight. And the moment it can't hold our weight, it would be a mistake to lean on it. Maybe we need to walk without holding things. But the idea is that we're confused and we say, yeah, we'll fix the world and then we'll know better. It's futile because we don't have the ability to fix the world. You know, I mean, Greta has a good heart, but I'm saying, but if somebody looks from outer space and sees a lot of people shouting in places and maybe spilling soup on Mona Lisa and jumping around, when you look from a distance, it doesn't look as if what they're doing is something that solves the problems that they're fighting for. It's just, in a sense, some kind of a semi-narcissistic manifestation of their existence, just like the kid that shouts in the shopping mall that he wants ice cream. He won't get ice cream, but if he shout loud enough, then he'll exist, you know? If he would just say, okay, I comply, let's go, he's not there. But the louder he shouts, the more he's there. And the more lost the kid is, the louder he'll shout. And nobody I know is more lost than us. And we're shouting our guts out. But basically, the only way to solve it is to tell a story differently. And when you tell a story, when you say, you know what, I like telling stories, but AI tells stories better than me, then I will tell you something. When I go to eat lunch, I usually eat in the same restaurant. When I go there and the waiters want to give me a menu, I say to him, are you kidding? You know what I'm going to have. And the waiter smiles and gives me what I'm going to have. Now, today I have apps that I can push a button and they'll tell me a million ways of choosing different foods. And basically, maybe I'll have a more balanced dietary supplement, whatever. But on the bottom line, where when I wake up myself up in the middle of the night and I don't remember who I am, I say, I'm the guy who goes to that restaurant and sit in that table and eat that dish. Now, you could say it's boring, but I could say it's a sense of identity. I always like to give this example that I came to New York and I wanted to buy my wife a perfume. And like an elderly conservative, you know, dry piece of crap, you know, I went into a place and they said to me, why do you want to buy her one perfume? And they gave me this set of, I think, 22 different scents. When you feel you're foxy, when you feel you're sophisticated, when you feel this. And I'm using Paco Rabanne since I was 16. I don't even like the smell of Paco Rabanne, but this is how I smell like. If I would buy you 20 perfumes, you wouldn't smell like yourself. You would smell like a mood. And that's the idea that we used to be entities and now we're a series of experiences. You know that I sometimes look at TikTok, what's trending? And I saw that one of the things that is trending is this thing that there are people who make soap bars that are filled with all kinds of colors and materials. And then they video themselves popping the soap bar. So you see all the colors coming out and you hear all those noises. Now, what this is, it's a sensation. It's not an idea and it's not a story. And we are being reduced now to sensations that exist only in the present. You know, I did a big workshop and I asked my students, I said to them, in every historical period, there is those stories that kind of, I don't think unite the world, but all the world acknowledges them as extraordinary. You know, like Uncle Tom's Cabin, The Great Gatsby, Hamlet. I can go all over the world and people know what I'm talking about. Kramer versus Kramer, the Titanic, Rambo. You know, we have these stories that we share. I asked him, please find the contemporary stories that we share. You know, it could be a book, it could be a film, but something that is way up there. They were struggling. And my best answer was that the stories that we all share is the cheating CEO in the Coldplay concert. That's the story that humanity shares. If you go to a forest in the Amazon and you know, and you say to people, ha ha, and his wife, ha ha, and he lost his job, ha ha, this is as far as we get. Now, this is not a story, this is a sensation, because if the cheating CEO was Adolf Hitler, it would become a story about crime and punishment. And if he was Mahatma Gandhi, it would be a story of how life isn't fair. But we don't know and we don't care. The same way that we go in the street and we see somebody sleeping on a banana peel. It's funny. It's funny if that person is a saint or if she's the most horrible person on the face of earth. It's just funny to see people falling. And that's how far as we go. And what I'm saying is that when you say AI can tell a story better than me, let him tell.
Wait, they don't tell a story better. They copy, they steal. They're like all four, like four.
Yeah, groups. But we also, yeah. we all steal. But I want to say something about Quick. And that's something, I saw a movie called Friday, based on the Michel Tournier novel. It's about kind of colonialism and stuff. And there is a scene there where Robinson Crusoe tries to teach Friday all kinds of Western stuff. And then he says to him, we're here on the island, it's so boring. Let's have a running competition. And Friday says, okay. So Robinson Crusoe says, we start here when I say go, and we have to get there. And then Robinson Crusoe says, go, and starts running with all his might. And he's panting and drooling and sweating and running. And next to him, Friday runs very slowly, but looks around the flowers and stuff. And then Robinson Crusoe reaches the end and falls down and says, I won. And then Friday said, why did you win? He said, so Robinson Crusoe said, because I was faster. And Friday said, hey, but I enjoyed it more. So AI can always be faster. You can always enjoy it more. If you're competing with the AI who's faster, you lost. If you're competing with the AI who enjoys it more, you're in such a better situation from a sociopathic entity. Really, you have an edge. So don't try to outsmart AI, because the moment that you try to outsmart AI, you are playing in the AI court. Because you can tell either two stories. You can say, we are actually AI, and now we're figuring it out, and we don't have anything transcendent. It's just a bug. So let the AI be our shepherd, you know? Or you could say, the AI is almost like me, but there are all kinds of things that are different. And if I go with the AI, I would have to say that there are mistakes. And if I go with myself, I could patronize AI saying, this is really those things that I can't explain. These are the things worth living for. The fact that I get depressed, the fact that I get stressed, it's a good thing because it creates my unique story. So I think that, you know, I give you an old story. I remember when I was a kid, there was always this most beautiful woman popular that is telling to sell you that. The woman that was most popular was Cindy Crawford. Do you remember this? She was a supermodel. They say that the reason that she's the most special, beautiful thing was because she had a mole here. And this imperfection made her something that wasn't an avatar made by a computer. She had this kind of perfect thing that kind of made her perfect. Now, this is the way that I see humanity. You know, if you remove Cindy Crawford's mole, she stops being her and she stops being special and she's just another very beautiful woman, you know. So I'm saying many times it's our faults that create our character. You know, if you'll be missing, you know, and I look for you and I go to the police, I'll never say, it's Mia, average height, two eyes, nice nose, two lips, nice lips, two shoulders. they'll never find you. But if I say, she's limping, she stutters, she spits on you when she speaks, she has this thing in her left eye, they'll find you in a minute. And that defect, their humanity. And we are living in a place that they say to us, what's distinct about you is something that can be fixed. But I don't want to fix it. I want to be slow. Why do I need to write a story fast? Is there somebody waiting outside my McDonald's stand and say, I have a bad parking, give me the story now? I'm not competing with anyone.
Yeah, but what is interesting is the way that the pace of technology has made us all kind of anxious because they're, you know, like, oh, we'll lose our job to the technology, or we'll lose, like, there's this increase amping up. And you talked about the way stories were before, the way wars were even covered before, there was a pace, you know, you had to wait for the news to come. You had to get the telegraph. The story had to be issues. There was that time for reflection. And so we are now, as you say, we're kind of following the pace of technology, which is completely inhuman. So I do want to go on to other things,
stories. Just one little thing about that, that you're talking about the pace. Now, I want to say to you, it looks as if it's the pace. It's not the pace at all. The idea is that when you go to in the street and you meet a friend in the distance and she's wearing a white dress and she's waving at you and she says, Mia, Mia, so great to see you. While you see that, you see a million other things. There is a guy burping next to her. There is a big sign saying loans here. There are many things, but you create a hierarchy and you say, my friend count. And her waving is more important than a dog crapping on the pavement next to her. What we don't have is that we don't have that, because when you retract with all the data, if you have a story, you say, I have a lot of information, but I know what's important. Now, today, what's our biggest problem? What's going in Gaza? What's going in Ukraine? What's going with the ecological things? What's happening in American universities? We don't know. So when you don't know, you have to keep everything. If you were able, I throw many balls at you and you say, I'm only catching the red one, it would become easy. So what I'm saying is that, again, it's not that we have too much information. It's the lack of the story. We don't have anywhere to put this information.
Oh, yeah, I agree. We're drowning in information and starved of story knowledge. But we've been living 30 years with social media. It's reshaped everything from how we connect. So look at our politics today. There's an epidemic of loneliness, and screens have rewired the way we connect, mediate our lives, and now AI is coming ready to turbocharge the same forces. It will shape culture, society, even how we see ourselves, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly, all faster than we can imagine. Like, who really wants to outsource their imagination to a bot halfway across the world, pretending there's a person on the other side? You know, already people are forming relationships with programs. I mean, how crazy is that? Maybe the real question isn't whether AI can create, it's how humans will respond and how will we use it. You know, I wanted to see it help us explore, experiment, and expand. But in the end, we have to get back to human storytelling, and I agree, human connection. And what you mentioned there, your mother, and of course you've written about both of your parents, and you had that very moving exhibition, which we discussed the last time you were on the show, honoring your mother, the stories she passed on to you, and how, you know, as you say, that wasn't her profession, but both of your parents were storytellers in their own right. The stories your father told himself when he was evading war, hiding in a hole in the ground, or the stories were a form of healing, it seems, from your mother. She seemed to make a magical world out of what was like suffering. So I think it's a way of survival. And you yourself have, you know, during this war, told stories to people who are survivors as a way of healing. So what did you learn from what your parents passed on to you? Or what have you learned in your life as a storyteller that how, you know, the importance of storytelling as a way of connection and healing and growth?
Yeah. So, you know, I think, let's say if someone would tie your hands and tell you it's only for 3 days, you would feel that every second of your life, your inability to use your hand the way that you want to use your hand. Now, this doesn't mean that you won't be able to live your life. You know, the people that like you will feed you and shower you and turn on the TV for you. But you will feel that you're not a complete human being. And I feel that When you don't tell your story, then it's as if you have a limited existence. And I think that when I talk about choices, we can always have some kind of choice. But I'm saying that the story we choose may be the most crucial choice that we make, because this story will affect all the other choices. You know, if the story that I tell myself is that I really want to speak to you because we talked on a podcast and it was very interesting, and I think that we are living in a very problematic time, and that it's important to share ideas so people will find their own way while listening to other people, then that's one story. If I say to myself, I published a new book and I have a newsletter on Substack and I must promote it, so I should go out and do PR, it's another story. Under those two stories, my experience of the interview would be different. My answers would be different. My attitude toward you would be different. So I'm saying the moment that you say, I'll make all the decision, I'll just outsource the story decision, then you become a slave. And then our current enslavement, it's really very, very tricky to catch, because what the only thing we do is that we outsource our decision making, we outsource our imagination, and we basically sit, and when we're very bored, we look on the phone and the phone will make it interesting to us. But it seems that all the time we're making decisions. Because you know what? When you go to Instagram, you can always say, I want to see the next movie. And then you feel that you choose. But if you'd be a slave and I say, Mia, so what would you want to do? Build me a pyramid or clean my house? Then you can have the illusion of freedom, but you don't have freedom. And the idea is that we don't feel enslaved because the feeling of enslavement usually comes from recognizing another ego and another intention. Now, with the AI, we don't feel that. It's not like we say, this asshole, he hates me. It's just this kind of big machine moving forward and pushing us. And if it pushes us, it has nothing against me. So I have nothing against it and I can't even recognize it. You know, so I'm saying, when I decided that I want to open this kind of storytelling program, it came from the idea that I feel that telling your story today is a life skill. You cannot be free if you can do anything on your own, but in the bottom line, you succumb to the story that is giving to you. And by the way, one of the things that parts of the story giving to you, it's a story telling you that it's important how fast you do things. That's the story that is giving to you, and that's not the story that you should take. I can tell you another thing. Doing things fast, you know why we need to do things fast? To survive. But now, because of AI, we don't need any help surviving. We can survive slow. So you should just see it as if a burden has been taken off your shoulder, and not that the AI is running faster than you.
Yeah, I get that. And actually, I'm not worried. I'm just expressing that I think it's important to address anything the tech bros are spending hundreds of billions of dollars on annually in a race to dominate and control our lives. You know, they're not doing this out of the goodness of their hearts. I mean, we've had the godfather of AI who created it, Geoffrey Hinton, telling us it's dangerous. And I've spoken with many AI experts and they've said it. I'm addressing their and my own concerns. I think it's important. And you've always had reservations too, I know, about technology. It's already beginning to affect all sectors of society, and I think it requires a deeper inquiry. In fact, in line with your own concerns when you say about people don't have stories anymore, and that's in part due to social media detaching us from what comes naturally to humans, talking to one another face to face. I think as if we look at just how social media has changed us, wait another 30 years and see what AI is going to do. Currently, AI programs can create an avatar singer and write their songs in 45 seconds or write a screenplay in 3 minutes. So, I mean, I don't know where the room is for our own story in that scenario.
I disagree, and I always like disagreeing with you, because what I think is that the model in which we're living now is that you have an outstanding artist, let's say Shakespeare, somebody, and then we say everybody will know this person and the work, and other people are less known. But this is not true even for today. When I go to my students, in an MFA program in Israel. And I say to them, for example, in Huckleberry Finn, there are three people who don't know what Huckleberry Finn is. So I'm saying that this model is broken. And the model that we're going to have is actually an ancient model in which people will communicate with very small communities. So I write stories, and let's say there will be 1,000 people around the world interested in my stories, and I write my stories for them, and they'll be my community. So in this kind of world, you don't have to be outstanding to have a function, because a writer, instead of becoming a movie star, he becomes the town doctor or the town priest or the town rabbi. I can tell you that nowadays, as a writer, I'm much more of a rabbi than I used to be. In the old time, I would publish a book every 7 years and then do a round and take photos with people and then sell my books. And that was my job. Today, I go to readings. People ask me questions. People say to me, you know what, you're a writer, but I have to ask you something about my daughter. Or you're a writer, but maybe I'm alone. Can you find me a partner? And this idea that the role of the writer, it stopped being somebody that manufactures content and that you admire as if, I don't know, she's a god or something like that. But it actually became a part of a needed dialogue. It's as if an artist is introducing humanity to the conversation because humanity is missing. And I'm saying that the word is going to need storytellers much more than it needed before, because it won't settle for one storyteller that will tell all the stories. We're going to break into many, many pieces, and each of those pieces, each of those broken rafts, we need a storyteller. And this storyteller doesn't have to be the champion of storytellers. It just needs to be determined and caring and understand that this is her identity and this is her role in life. And if she used to be a banker or an accountant, now she's the person that for 20, 30, 50, 100 people around her, she helps make sense of life. And no job is more glorifying and more yearned for than that. You know, to be the person who keeps all this crap together, keeps it from falling apart.
Yeah, that keeps us sane. I should completely agree with that. In the last 20 years, we lived for a few centuries where the written word was prominent and dominant. And now we see we're returning, which I think is very interesting, particularly for writers like you, whose writing seems very much based on an oral tradition. You get something else when we hear you read your stories or you hear actors read your stories aloud. You feel it's like someone speaking to you more so than other kind of writers. And I think we're returning to oral tradition. So I completely agree. And it's nice to think there's a silver lining of us returning to storytellers almost around the fire, telling our stories. I do want to talk about a few things. You talked about particular audiences. You mentioned you do have this Substack newsletter where you share a lot of these stories have also been published there, or the New Yorker or elsewhere, McSweeney's. So you have the Substack called Alphabet Soup, which I was happy also to illustrate maybe two of your stories for that. And then you also have the new Jewish Theological Seminary MFA program that you're director of. You're heading off to New York soon for that. So just tell us about these are two particular groups, and that's a little bit like splintering off of your audiences. So tell us about those experiences and how they came about.
So again, you know, I feel that there is something about storytelling that has to be dynamic. And I feel that I kind of live in a world that changes in an accelerated speed. And sometimes it kind of feels that, let's say, in the good old time, I could sit here and take your portrait. But now, as I take your portrait, your nose grows bigger and you have flowers on your head and then they fall. And then, so it's difficult because all the time I'm trying to show people something, but this something is not stable. So I did a movement in three ways. One of them was doing the Substack because I felt that I can't wait 6 or 7 years for my work to be published because things are kind of changing all the time and I have to deal with that rapidly. And the other thing was trying to do this educational system, basically saying, I'm not going to teach you how to be a Booker-winning novelist, but I'm going to teach you how to tell your story. And maybe you become successful and maybe you just be able to tell your partner what you're feeling in a better way, and that's what you're going to get. Then I'm shifting a little bit from the world of giving lecture to more rock and roll world, in which I perform with rock and roll artists, trying to get my stories to people who don't read and to an audience that is really outside of the intellectual realm. And I'm saying all those three movements, it's not that I have a goal. It's just that's where I'm heading. I want to meet people in a rock concert and see if I can read a story short enough that they won't throw bottles at me. I want to create a program that would not be about excelling, but it would be about understanding yourself better. I want to do a Substack in which every week I can share idea, story, a thought, and that there would be people around me that are interested in that and that give me feedback, that send me writing the next thing. Now, all those things are adjustments. I think that the worst thing that an artist or a human being can do now would be to try and hold on to the old world, to say, this is what I used to do. It was like that. I want to do it. Why do people don't react the same way? You know, it's as if like, you know, if I would be an ice seller going from door to door selling ice, or if I would be a Nazi hunter, you know, it would be a smart thing to ask myself, what do you want from life? Because there aren't any Nazis left and people have fridges. So instead of insisting on some kind of an odd and rigid identity, you should find it yourself a new one.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that it's all of, goes back to what you're saying about telling your own story or meeting people where they are. I know that one of your stories in Autocorrect is called Cornerstone, and a friend is drafted to write a eulogy for a boy who his family has been wiped out. But it's all going back to like, what we were talking about also before about technology is like we're letting people write stories for us. So we have to reclaim that autonomy and find out what works for us. And it might not be writing the great American novel. You know, I know that you're not, you're just trying to find what excellence means for them, because I think every life is important and a value and worth sharing.
Yes. What I really think is that when you talk about this kind of AI human competition, then there are two things, at least two things, that human being can do and AI can't do. And I think that it's the ability for obscurity and ambiguity. These are two things that, you know, when you have plus and zero, you see them as mistake. Let's say, if I say to you, Donald Trump is a danger to democracy, but he has such an amazing charisma and nice character, then this is something that is very difficult for AI to make this dance, you know, because it can, if I ask you, are you for it or against it? Is this thing a massacre or not a massacre? Then the human thing to do would be to stutter, to say, Now, when we meet the AI and in the AI world, we treat our humanity as a mistake, as something that needs to be corrected, to be outsourced and solved. You know, for example, if you do something bad to me, okay, if you steal money from me, so me saying, you know what, this, I trusted Mia and she betrayed my trust, but she's a good person and she stole that money because she wanted to buy herself a canvas and she seemed to be sorry. So will I forgive her? How will I forgive her? All these are so complicated, you know? So we live now in a world saying, what's the AI solution? Let somebody tell me if I should forgive Mia or not. Let somebody tell me if I can hug her and say everything is okay. Because I don't know why, because this is outside of my jurisdiction. Why? Because an AI wouldn't know that. So I'm saying that our fight is not to be better than the AI and what the AI does better than us. Our fight is to keep what's human in us, and that we are now saying if the AI doesn't have it, we don't need it either.
Yeah, and what's human in us, I think it becomes hard during times of conflict and war. And I know that you mentioned being blacklisted and you've always been outspoken. I mean, for decades, you've wanted peace and you've spoken up for that. You've written about it. You've written lots of editorials and stories. And so it must be particularly difficult for you, because from the outside you might be seen as one thing, or you're Israeli, and then from the inside you're speaking up, and finding that balance is difficult. And you've also said that to criticize Benjamin Netanyahu and Israeli government, how they're prosecuting the war, it's not to be anti-Semitic. It's not to protest to want peace and you want human rights for everyone, and to lament all deaths, all kidnappings around the world. This is not a betrayal of one side or the other. We should all be for human rights.
Yeah, yeah. Look, the thing is, especially when it's liberals who hate me or boycott me, I feel for them. I understand that they want to do a good thing, and I understand that they feel that kicking me is a good feel. But what I want to say is that when you tell it this way, it almost sounds like it's good against evil, but it's not. It's basically authenticity against automaticity. I had an interview a week ago with a journalist, and I explained to the journalist in 50 how I see what's going on in Gaza, explaining in detail that we're blowing up houses and buildings and evacuating population, and that we don't give them enough food, and that every day people are shot as they want to get their food. And then in the end, he said to me, so is it genocide? And I said to him, I'm a writer. I write, I give you my fullest description, and you tell me. So he said, no, no, I want you to say it. And I said to him, but it's not my job to say what you want me to say. I talked about my parents who were a Second World War survivor. I never used the word genocide in my life for the Jewish people, because I don't want to use this word. I'm describing maybe something that one could easily call a genocide. And he says, but please say if it's genocide or not. And I said to the journalist, you're a super smart person and you're sensitive too. Why do you do something that is so arbitrary and dumb? And he says, I know it, but that's what my editor asked me. And the editor had asked him that because the editor had used AI too much, you know? And the idea is that when you write a computer program, you say, if the word genocide appears, send him there. If it doesn't appear, send him there. But if somebody gives a big description, what will I do with that? What kind of a decision, what kind of a conclusion will I have from that, you know? And I'm saying that I feel that I'm being kind of boycotted 360 degrees, not necessarily because of my opinions. Okay, in Israel, because of my opinions, but mostly because of the fact that it's like a cult or a clan that wants me to keep to some kind of a series of codes that I refuse to keep to. And in many of those situations, people, I say to them, do you want to read what I wrote? You know, like liberals who boycotted me. And they say, we don't care what you wrote. We want you to do this and this and this and this. So I really, really feel that for me, when I look around the world, I don't align myself by people who hold my values, because so many people who hold my values are narrow-minded and don't take any decision and have no chance of changing their mind. So I'm saying, you know, it's really like with me and somebody who like to engage in dialogue, 80% of the time I say, I'm not going to answer this person because they don't want to listen. It doesn't matter.
I think that you're so right. For me personally, the word, whether it's genocide or people say ethnic cleansing, I just see that there's been a lot of deaths. And that's not, and within Israel and within Gaza, that's what's important. It's the actual lives. It's the full description. It's the whole story. So I'm not stuck on a word.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm stuck on.
But what I always say is that we can call it different names, but names are not as important as action. So let's say if I say it's ethnic cleansing and want to stop it, and you say genocide and you want to stop it, and the third person says, it's just horrible, but it's neither. Then I say we're a coalition, because the people who are dying don't care. They just want us to stop it. And the fact is that because we are unable to stop it, then we take our frustration on the other people. You know, it's really like in Israel, it's always the same. Whenever the government and the army do something horrible, they boycott artists and academics that are all liberal left-wing, and the artists are already boycotted and blacklisted. But the word boycott, why? Because if I'm an artist, it's much easier to boycott an artist than to boycott a bank. So the question is, am I doing something that resonates in the world, or am I doing the things that is the easiest for me to do? It's not a good solution. So what I want to say, there are many things that we talked about, but I really think we all have a hope for a good and full life. It's just a question of reference. I got on a taxi a couple of weeks ago. The driver recognized that I'm a left-wing liberal because I'm outspoken, and most taxi drivers are right-wing conservative, not to say racist. And he said, I know you, and we're going to have a good long talk until I drop you off. And I said to him, listen, man, I don't mind arguing with you, but I will only argue about things that the outcome of our argument will have an effect in real life. So I'm willing to argue with you about war in Gaza only if you convince me that the war is good, we'll go to Gaza in your car, take guns and help them. And if you, I'll convince you that war is bad, we'll go to Gaza and we'll stand in front of the soldiers and tell them not to shoot. If you're willing to do that, I'll argue with you. So the driver said to me, why do you say this bullshit? Nobody's going to listen to us anyway. So I said to him, you know what? So let's argue if we stop in a gas station and buy a Coca-Cola or not, because I had enough of arguing things that I don't have any effect about it. When I make this argument, it makes me feel important. I feel like a prime minister or maybe an American president. And I say, what? Trump is dumb. I'm smarter than Trump. But in the end, it has no effect in life. So I really say that the moments that we'll be able to limit ourselves to the scope of the effect of our action. This doesn't mean that we should comply with things that we cannot stop. But the core of our action should be not to stop people from saying words. You know, when I was a kid, they would say, sticks and stones may break your bones, but a word would do me no harm. We are living in the world, people will murder you for a word, and that you can get away with murder as long as you shut up. So it's time to take this reverse word and put it back so it will make some sense.
Well, you've always been a person of principle and vision and action, and we need stories. So we are stories. So thank you, Edgar Keretz,
for
in a world that's moving so fast and is increasingly coming to resemble one of your stories. Thank you for celebrating what it means to be human with hope and humor and sharing the importance of storytelling and connection. By reminding us that we each need to be authors of our own stories, you value each life and how each of us can contribute something important to the world. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you, Mia. It's always a pleasure speaking with you.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer was Sam Myers. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram on @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.